Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we speak to one of our most accomplished film composers, Mark Mancina, and conduct roundtable discussions on some of this season's finest films. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We're very happy to be with you here tonight, and thank you, everyone, for listening in live. My name is Jamie, and Jerry, hello.
Hi, how's everyone doing?
Chris, hello.
Hello there. Good to be here.
We are the Movie Geeks, and we couldn't be more thrilled to bring you the show tonight. We have some great shows beyond this evening, too. Let me tell you a little bit about them at the top of this show here. Wednesday night, We welcome Blog Talk Radio CEO Alan Levy, so you guys can get a sense. I know that a lot of you guys are tuned into our show. Maybe you guys have found some other shows on Blog Talk Radio as well, but he'll be on to discuss what the format entails, how easy it is for everyone else to start their own show here on this forum, and the inspirations behind it and how he sees it progressing in the future. So that's going to be an exciting discussion. We'll also have character actor Tony Zinzamici, and it's actually a very inspiring story, and I wanted to share it with everyone Wednesday night, so please tune in for his story Wednesday night as well. Very exciting news. The Movie Geeks, here you go, guys. I don't even think I've told you guys yet. The Movie Geeks have a world exclusive next Sunday.
I think I know what it is, but I'm still very excited.
Can I get a dun-dun-dun?
Dun-dun-dun!
We are going to welcome director Marcus Nespel. As you know, he directed the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre a few years back. And he has been hired on, it was just announced last week, to direct a remake of Friday the 13th. Now, whatever you feel about Friday the 13th, I know it's very beloved in some circles, but it's kind of, we're very curious what the tone will be, what direction they're taking this, because it's a high-profile project. It's for Michael Bay's production company, and they've been behind several of the horror film remakes. And he's going to come on our show, and he's going to give us the scoop on Friday the 13th. No one else has it, folks. We got it.
This is it. Next Monday morning, everyone will be talking about this.
Dun-dun-dun! So we're excited about that. That's great. Also next Sunday, we have Anthony Artis. He's a documentary filmmaker and the author of the book Shut Up and Shoot, documentary guide. And it's a great book. I've been reading it this week. On the following Wednesday, we have Raymond J. Barry, one of our great character actors. I mean, really. I mean, if you think about the films that he's been involved in, his latest film is The Dewey Cox Story. It's that John C. Reilly.
Yeah, The Walk Hard. That looks very funny.
Yes, it does look funny, and anything with John C. Reilly.
You know what he was good in, Raymond? Was it Interview with the Assassin?
Absolutely.
That was a really good movie.
Absolutely. And I think back of the movies that mean a lot to me of the past 10, 15 years. Born on the 4th of July, he played
right.
Tom Cruise's father. He played the grieving father that seeks the counsel of Susan Sarandon in Dead Man Walking.
Right.
You're talking about just an incredible presence on film. Just, it's one of those quintessential character actors that elevate anything that they're in.
Right.
And so we're very pleased to have him on the show, and that's next Wednesday, I believe. That's December 5th, and our Wednesday 10 p.m. Eastern show. How are you guys been? How's your Thanksgiving been?
It's been good.
How about you, Chris?
It was very filling. Very
yeah, that's a good word for it.
Yes.
Filling to the top.
Yeah, yeah. We've been living off of leftovers all weekend. It's probably why I feel so sluggish right now. After you eat so much turkey, it's just want to sleep your life away. Okay, let's get started. Tonight we are honored to speak with one of our most talented and versatile film composers. Mark Mancina has built a remarkable career, giving musical voice to films of every genre, including the action spectacles Twister, Speed, and Bad Boys, thrillers like Training Day and Shooter, the dramas Return to Paradise and Moll Flanders, and family entertainments including Tarzan and The Lion King. His uncanny ability to musically express the emotional core of every film has resulted in some of cinema's most unique and unforgettable scores of the past 20 years, and has gone on to earn Mancina 3 Grammys, an American Music Award, and even a Tony nomination. In his new film, August Rush, Mancina delivers one of his most personal and passionate works, effortlessly blending rock, gospel, classical, and avant-garde into a gorgeous musical tapestry that never fails to touch the heart and uplift the spirit. It's a great pleasure to welcome to our show film composer Mark Mancina. Mr. Mancina, are you with us?
I'm with you. How are you doing?
Hey, thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
That was a great introduction. I wanted to kind of be writing it down so I could give it to my agent.
I'll send you a CD copy of it. Now, August Rush, this seems like a dream job for a composer. How did this project come about for you?
You know, in some ways it was. It was a producer who really kind of saw it through, because it was a very, very difficult movie to get made. Most studios didn't want to make the movie, and
right.
It was very, very hard, and he had to kind of, finance a good part of it, and then Warner Brothers decided to join in with him. But I had worked with him previously on a movie called Moll Flanders, which was way, way back in the 90s. It was a Robin Wright Penn movie, and it was actually an Irish score. It was really fun, and I had worked with him previously, and he had this script, and he was going to have Hans Zimmer, the composer, do it, and Hans is a very busy guy and didn't work out, and they called me, and all of a sudden I read the script, and I noticed that actually in the original script, some of my music, my previous music, was written in the script, which is really weird, just kind of a, happenstance. And once I read it, I realized that the whole film was going to be score, and I realized that if I was going to get to be this kid, August Rush, if I got to write all of the music that comes out of his head,
right.
That's a pretty great chance at something, because you don't usually get those kind of scripts.
Oh, yeah. So what about this material spoke to you?
Well, I do believe that we are connected through music in some weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly don't know why. But I just know in my own life, when I was 6 years old, I was really, really drawn to playing music, and I just knew that that's what I needed to do. I had no idea kind of what I was going to do with it, and certainly when I got out of high school and I was not making any money and having to basically play in restaurants, in Mexican restaurants, to try to make a living for years,
right.
And it was really amazing the other night, because we were in New York, and it was the premiere of August Rush, and at the exact same time, 7 p.m., was the 10th year anniversary of the Lion King musical.
Oh.
And that changed my life as well, only this time I had my 6-year-old daughter with me. And so, she got to experience this, my music, and this project in a different way, but, through me. So it's just this ongoing, I just kind of thought that's the real circle of life. I mean, that's what the circle of life is.
Yeah.
It's this kind of handoff that we all have to do at some point. And I get to do it musically. A lot of people do it with, photography or any art form, that you do that you find special with your kids is a really amazing way of kind of passing the torch kind of thing.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk about Lion King in a little bit, but with August Rush, it seems like it was an unusual experience because you were basically part of the collaborative process from the get-go.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to being brought in after everything shot.
Yeah, usually what a composer's job is, what I always consider it to be, is the enhancer, the great enhancer, whether that be romantic, comedy, drama, action, whatever it is. When they have the film, I remember when I first saw Speed, and they didn't have my score or anything, and they were using music from The Terminator, which, I like The Terminator, but that music is very cold, and it's not a thematic score.
Right.
And it really felt like Speed was missing something to me when I saw it. I was like, this is a cool film, but, it's so cold, and it doesn't have any kind of heroic, heart to it somehow. And so that was kind of my goal with that film. That's a normal film. You kind of come into it when they're still cutting it together, but you get a chance to sort of see what they've shot. August Rush was completely the opposite. It, you know, all of the music, I would say, you know, 80% of it had to be conceived and figured out and recorded before they shot it.
Right.
So that's a very different process. Now, I'm used to that process because I really go back to playing in bands and all of that kind of stuff where you're writing songs, you're writing music. You know, you're not writing to a picture. So, you know, it wasn't like it was foreign to me, but it was certainly a different way to do a film score.
And you basically worked from the end of the picture, you know, the climactic moment of the picture back.
Yeah, because they, you know, and when I read the script, I'm reading this ending, and I'm it's, you know, the point of the movie is not that August Rush is the greatest composer and he's a Mozart. That's not the point. That's what, you know, some critics have missed that point because it went right over them, but the point is that he has one focus, and that is to find his parents, somehow connect to his mom and dad somehow through his music.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his goal. So when I read the ending, and really what the ending idea was that all of the music that's inside of him sort of comes together in a big piece of music. Well, that means music from his mom and music from his dad and music that he may have subliminally heard growing up, and music that's inside of him. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, why do we gravitate towards certain melodies or certain bands? Why, you know, why do some guys, like, really connect to certain bands and other people don't connect to those groups? I don't know what all that is, but there's something in there. There's something really strong in there.
Yeah.
And that's
what
the film's about.
Excuse me, Jamie, if I
could.
I saw the movie Wednesday night, and I agree with you. If that is the goal of the film, you accomplish that 110%. The movie is one of the most magical films I've seen in a long time.
I'm glad to hear you say
that. No, I mean, it is a really well-done piece of film, and it's like a modern fairy tale, modern mythology, and your choice of music pieces and the music is very well done. But I always took it that was the movie. It's spelled out in the beginning, really, that his goal is to use the music to find his parents.
Right.
I didn't get the, you know, I know what you mean. I read those reviews too, where the critics were, you know, it did go over their heads, and I do also.
Well, and they were also, you know, they were also like saying that. I mean, it's not like I wrote the piece at the end and just wrote whatever I wanted. Like, if somebody said, write any piece of music that you want, Mark, and we're going to use that for the end. I mean, I had to visualize what, when you're that age, when you're 11 years old, that kind of passion and you're lost and you're in the city and you're hearing all the city sounds, and how do you put all that into a piece of music?
Right.
It was scripted in some ways, but, you know, music is so weird that if when it says, and then his father bolts from the taxi cab, and the music that August is playing becomes part of the score of the movie. Well, how long is that, and
right.
how fast is it? You know, there's a lot of questions in there.
It's a magical in a sense, and you'll forgive my comparison, but the first thing that came to mind was just The End of the Natural. It was that kind of magic.
You know what? That's a great that's, you know, it's a wonderful movie, and that's Randy Newman. So I mean, you're talking about. I mean, to be
that's
even
the first thing that came to mind. Now I'm going to say this right now, and I wouldn't. And just because we have you on the show and all that, this movie really grabbed me. And I wouldn't, you know, if I didn't feel that way, I wouldn't say anything. But it really just the last 20 minutes of the movie. I don't care who you are. If you're not touched by that, you got something wrong. But it does remind me in a very good way of the End of the Natural, when they're all reunited. And what I like about the movie also is it doesn't spell it out for you. It's very organic.
Well, you know what?
It comes right from the heart.
That's Kirsten. That's the director. You know, she's a very young, and I hate to use these words because these are the words that people use with music, and I hate it, but she's kind of raw. You know, she's not glossy Hollywood. She didn't have $100 million to make this movie, and you know, it's really not a studio film.
Not at all.
It's sort of promoted like it's just one of the many big films that are coming out. It really wasn't, you know, we didn't have much money at all. And
she got her father's gift.
Well, I think so.
I think she got from, especially when you watch My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father, she definitely got her father's gift.
You know what I mean? I agree with you. And I that's why when they told me she was going to do it, I thought, oh, that's fantastic, because she'll keep it kind of raw and,
right.
and not too pretty all the time and not too beautiful, you know?
That's right.
You know, you've correct me if I'm wrong, but you recently performed your August Rush work in a live concert in New York City with the cast?
Well, here, you know, there's two different things. I performed it in L.A.
Okay.
And that was really cool. And that was for the Warner Brothers studio and for their marketing department. So that was, and I was with John Andrasik, who wrote some of the songs in the movie from Five for Fighting. So I played part of my score, and then he, and then I played with him. And we had the cellist from the film, who was in the film, actually, who plays on August's piece. Her name is Jen Kuhn. That was really exciting. Then they told me that they were going to have a concert in L.A. of all of the music from the score, but they were going to have it before the movie opened, which I thought, yeah, but nobody's going to know what the music means. Mm. And what they ended up doing is they moved it to the Berklee School of Music. And I couldn't make that because I was actually in New York for The Lion King, so I couldn't make the concert. But I saw everybody, Phil Ramone produced the concert, and I saw them at the premiere, and they said, Mark, you're not going to believe this. We played the music from August Rush live, and they don't even, people don't know the music. There was a standing ovation at the end.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, my God. And he goes, I'm not kidding you. He goes, I just, it touched people somehow. And so that was a, you know, for me, that's a thrill, you know, because I'm used to doing, you know, I've done films with way bigger budgets, and I've done films that have been a lot of fun, but this film is so different than anything that you usually get asked to do.
Yeah, it feels very, very pure, and that's what I like about music to begin with. It's a very pure kind of connective, creative outlet, and one of the major themes of the film that speaks to me is kind of the importance of music in the life of a child, and you'd mentioned that you got turned on by music at a young age. I think you said 6 years old.
Yeah.
How important do you think, what do you think is missing when musical education is lacking from the schools?
Well, you know, the thing about music, and I'm sure, and I don't know because I only sort of know music. I don't have too many other things that I can do. I wish I could, actually, but I just don't. I'm just not good at anything. But it's kind of, you kind of can't leave it alone. Like, even if you can't deny it from yourself. I mean, even if you can't make a living at it, I know so many people that just love to play music and have a guitar or play. They just love it, and they would never not do it. It might not be what they do for a living, but they just will always play music. You kind of can't deny yourself those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with a school, I mean, for me growing up, I was in L.A., and then a little bit later on in Huntington Beach, there wasn't really a music outlet in the school. My music outlet was coming home. I couldn't wait to get home and putting on an album. Whatever it was, I don't care if it was classical, I don't care if it was whoever, you know, whatever band was happening, didn't matter to me. It was just, it was sort of this, my own world, my own place to go.
Mm.
I think with school, you know, exposure is the key. You know, somebody will play you something from a band you never heard of and you kind of go, oh, yeah, I kind of like that. I don't know. I sort of like it. Then you think about it the next day, and you're like, yeah, I did like that. And then you get it, and then you're really into it, you know.
Right.
But if you wouldn't have been exposed to it, you wouldn't know. So I think that with schools, I think exposure to music, people find their way. Some people love jazz. Some people love pop. Some people love hip-hop. You know, it's whatever. But if you don't hear it, if you only hear hip-hop or if you only hear a certain style, you're not going to know what else is out there.
Right, right. So when you started, did you give any thought at all to film composition as the place where you wanted to end up?
You know, it's an interesting question because I've thought about that myself because I don't know about you, but when I look back at my childhood, I'm pretty foggy sometimes. I'm kind of like, all I remember is I just wanted to make like 10 bucks somehow and playing at parties and doing all that. But no, you know what? I remember kind of thinking that would be a good job when I get older. You know, like that's a good job for an old guy to write film scores. But, you know, I grew up in such an era in the 70s and 80s when, gosh, you know, they were band after band after band after band, and they didn't sound like the other band. I mean, Zeppelin didn't sound anything like Black Sabbath, and Black Sabbath didn't sound like the Beatles, and the Beatles didn't sound like the Stones. They had influences, but they didn't sound alike, and so there was such diversity. And if you look back at film scores, I mean, I remember going to see Jaws and hearing that music, and I thought, God, it's real. I love that music. It's staying in my head.
Mm.
You know, I that's John Williams. I mean, I got to be raised on such great writers in so many areas of music, whether it be, you know, films, or then I'd go home and put on an album, and I'd hear, you know, whatever I'd put on, and I'd go, wow, that, like, Yes. I remember the first time I heard the band Yes, and I was like, wow, that guitar player is amazing. I mean, how do you play like that? It was a whole different, but I loved Clapton, but it was nothing like Clapton. So, you know, it just opened doors everywhere. I'm not so sure it's the same now. I mean, you kind of have to seek it out a little bit more now. You got to search around, which, you know, that's okay. People do it on their computer, and that's what I do. But I hope that it stays accessible to everybody so that people really search it out.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. So how did your first break into film composition come about?
You know what? I was playing bars at night. So at the time, you know, I would have to learn the top 40, but I would pick the songs because there were certain songs. Like, we tried to do certain things, and I would refuse. I just couldn't. I could not play the song. Like, I remember I was like a teenager, and we were, you know, Saturday Night Live was huge. I mean, Saturday Night Fever was huge, and we had to play some of those songs. And I got to a point where I said, you know what, I know we can make a living playing these songs. I can't do it. You know, I just cannot do it. And so I would sort of pick the top 40 songs that I liked. And it was sort of, you know, at that time it was kind of Steely Dan and stuff that was a little bit, you know, more challenging to try to learn the chords and try to play them and everything else.
Right.
I also got a job with a company that did deer gutting deer gutting videos. They would, like, direct a video, how to gut a deer, how to hunt and shoot a deer.
You have the same job I have.
All this horrible stuff. But you know what? They wanted music. And, you know, it was, I mean, at the time, I didn't even think about how gross it was. I was just thinking, this is cool. I mean, I got to figure out how to make the music go with the picture. And back then, you didn't really have any sync. You know, you didn't have a way to really sync them together. The machines wouldn't run together back then.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to have to just literally do what people used to do, which I didn't know, but you would push play on the video recorder and push play on your recorder at the same time and then start recording and then try to get, you know, in line with it. It was really,
right.
And you'd have to start from the beginning every time. But, you know, I got like $5,000 to do one of those things.
A deer gutting video, really?
That was, yeah, and that was like, you know, that was 3 or 4 months of work in a club. So I wouldn't get them very often. I'd get them, you know, every once in a while they'd call me and they'd say, okay, this one's about, you know, how bears hunt, you know, and okay, great. But, you know, I sort of got the syncing thing together, and I was really good at instrumental music. I realized it because I was kind of right now all of a sudden I was just writing instrumental music, and it was pretty good. It was actually was, you know, I thought it was really quite good. So when I did get a shot, which this is what happens in life, you know, if you prepare yourself and then you walk around moping around all day going, I never get a break, I never get a break. Everybody gets a break. It's whether you kind of it's whether you're ready for it when it happens.
Yeah.
Because everybody sort of gets, I don't mean everybody, but most people get this little glimmer of a chance at something. And when they dive in and they're kind of prepared, then they can rise. And what happened was, you know, I got this phone call to work on a movie called Days of Thunder. It was a Tom Cruise movie. And the composer, which was Hans, had heard some demo of mine, and he said, I need you to work on this song. I need you to arrange the song, produce the song, and I need you to come down right now. So I put my stuff in my trunk of my Vega, and I drove up to L.A., and I would do that every day. I'd go set up, and I'd go start, and I just knew what I was doing. I'd, like, immediately, because I had just sort of done it in my bedroom for so long, I sort of knew what I was doing.
Sure.
And from there, you know, came, do you think you can do this little movie called Monkey Trouble? Hey, do you think you can do this movie called Speed? It's a really small little movie. Do you think you can write themes and do this movie? And I was like, ready to go. Are you kidding? Let's go. You know?
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about that collaboration with Jan de Bont, because you've worked with him several times.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite scores ever is your score from Twister. It is so sweeping and fun and free feeling. And it almost has an old Western feel to it.
Yeah, it is definitely Western.
Was that a discussion to maintain that kind of Western feeling?
You know what? That is back when, those were great times. You know, we had done Speed, and then, you know, he had this script called Twister, and he flew me out to, I want to say Kansas or Nebraska, I'm not sure where, Omaha I think it was, where they were filming. You know, he flew me there just to get a sense of being in the flat Midwest. I had been to the Midwest before, but, you know, when they're filming, it's really exciting. And just to kind of be around it and see what they were doing. And I don't know, the whole sort of Western Copeland, but yet with some rollicking fun excitement to it. It just sort of came to me, and I wrote that that opening piece, when they're going over the wheat fields, that was one of my favorite pieces, and I wrote that to start with, and then kind of scored the rest of the movie. And he really liked it. You know, Jan is great, and he really liked it, and he kind of let me go my own way on that film, and it was really fun.
Fantastic score.
Thank you.
Tell me about
you know, they didn't really like it. I mean, I have to tell you that Steven Spielberg produced that movie, and
yeah.
He didn't like it. And he didn't like the music, and he didn't like the editor didn't like the music, which was Michael Kahn. He's a very, very good editor, fantastic. And you know, these guys work with John Williams, so for me, I just wanted to impress them, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted them to love it. And you know, when you can tell when somebody doesn't, it's like when you cook something and people don't like it, you can tell. They just kind of go, yeah, it's great, you know.
Really?
That kind of thing. But you know what? Jan loved it. And I still get, you know, most of the time what I normally get from people, now that August Rush is out, I'm getting great phone calls from people, but I normally get Bad Boys and Twister as the ones that people usually tell me are their favorite ones. So it's kind of interesting that you pointed that out, because I appreciate that. I worked really hard on it, you know.
No, absolutely. It's an amazing piece of work. That's another thing, tell me about your ideal collaboration with a director. I mean, you've mentioned that your relationship with Jan de Bont is great, but what kind of communication do you need from a director?
You know, you just got to know what they're wanting, and it's hard because they, you know, they're not musicians normally. In fact, it's worse if they are musicians, because then they try to communicate on that level, which is, if they're very trained, then that's kind of difficult also. It kind of like if I were a director and I'm writing music and I'm communicating to the director on a director level, it's kind of weird, you know. My collaboration with Jan was really great, especially on Speed. I'll never forget when I played him the main title. I mean, I he came into my room and I played the opening main title for him. This is after we'd been working on it, and he took a big risk with me because he fought for me to have that movie, and the studio didn't want me. They didn't know who I was, and you know, they thought I was going to wreck the movie, and you know, there's a lot of politics involved. But he believed in me, and when he heard the main title, he fell all, just about out of his chair laughing in relief. He loved it so much, and I could tell that he was just so excited and so like, this is amazing. This is going to blow people's minds, you know. And it was really, really exciting. And the other guy is Antoine Fuqua, who I did Training Day.
Training Day, absolutely.
Right, that's right.
You know, he's deep, and he's difficult to, you know, you want to please him. He's a great guy and he's a wonderful artist, but you know, you want to get where he wants to go, and he's got a lot of ideas, and he likes to experiment, which is really fun. And I love that combination of us. I loved what we did on Shooter. I thought Shooter was, you know, I think Shooter deserved better from, I mean, people that have seen it really liked it.
It's a great movie.
Well.
Yeah.
I thought it was really, you know,
I like that movie a lot.
I thought it was a good, I like the pace of it. I like the understatement of it. I like the fact that the score is kind of subliminal. It's not, doesn't bang you over the head, you know. I really loved that collaboration with him. It was really great. But Training Day for me was really fun because it was so disturbing, and it was really fun to write that really dark stuff, man. And you know, some of the subject matter in that movie was so unnerving for a guy like me, you know. I'm sitting there, I'm kind of like the white guy in the room.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, that's me right there, and these guys are going to kill me, you know.
Yeah.
I know exactly how I'd feel.
Yeah. So when you first see a Training Day, just to get a little bit into your process, when you see a first cut of Training Day, you see it's a gritty film, urban, it deals with corruption. What musical thoughts start to form in your mind?
You know, I can tell you specifically with Training Day because I wish they would have had time or money. You know, the first cut that I saw was about 3 hours long, and it had all sorts of other twists and turns in the story that were amazing.
Hmm.
And, you know, when they had to cut it down and the studio stepped in and they had to film the ending with everybody, you know, shooting everybody, you know, it's just kind of like, okay, here we go. But the original one that I saw was really riveting. So what... The first thing I thought was a lot of the music they had put in as placeholders was really good stuff. And that's always a good feeling, but it's also a little intimidating.
Mm.
Heat was, you know, I love that score. I love that movie. And a lot of the music was from Heat. So I was listening to it going, God, you know, this is hard to top, you know.
Right.
The other thing I thought was I'm not going to write any urban music. You know, I am not from the streets. I am not going to kid myself by going out and buying loops and putting some drum loops and thinking that I know the rhythms of peoples of L.A., because I don't.
Right.
What I do know is I lived in L.A., and what I do know is L.A. is not one thing. It is a mixture of cultures, and that's why if you listen to the beginning of the movie, it's Asian. The very beginning of that movie, I started with Asian ideas.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, you know, Chinatown, I'm thinking about all the different areas. There's a bit of a Spanish-Mexican flavor to some of it. It's very dreamy. You know, I wanted to stay away from the obviousness. If they wanted hip-hop, I said, get Dre. And you know what? They did. They got Dre. And Dre wrote that one little piece in there that's great, you know. So that's the level I was thinking on. And I was very fortunate, too, because I could say that to Antoine, and he understood that. There are a lot of directors that would say, no, we hired you, man. Write, you know, start writing stuff, you know.
Yeah. Tell me about CD soundtracks, because we spoke with John Ottman a few months ago.
Yeah.
And he said a mistake that a lot of people make is that when you're a film composer, you're composing the music first and foremost to fit with the film, not necessarily to sound good on a CD soundtrack.
That's a good point. Although the only thing I would say is that there are a lot of composers in Hollywood that mix for the CD and don't care about the film.
Really?
Yeah. But that's because it gets them more work. I've always felt the opposite way. I feel the way John does. I feel like you got to make it sound great for the film. That's the whole point of it.
That's the big kahuna, I mean.
Well, but you know what? Unfortunately, it kind of isn't in the respect of those CDs that go out. People use those, what they call a temp track, when you're a director making a film and you don't have a composer yet, so you find music and throw it up against your film. Well, what do? You go buy CDs. And you use that music. And then you find out, oh, you know what? I love this music. Who is this guy? Yeah. Oh, it's so-and-so. Oh, let's get him. That's how people get jobs.
Okay. All right.
So
that makes sense.
If you mix it for the CD, then you're ensuring that somebody may hear it and love it. If you mix it for the film, you're really working for the best of the film, which is what I like to do. But not everybody does that.
Right.
Yeah. Do you feel that the best scores, though, can have both identities, can work the same way, for work equally well for the purposes of the film and when you just put on the CD? Or?
I got to tell you, I do believe that. There's a lot of levels, though. I mean, I have to say, I have seen movies that I thought the score was brilliant, and then I take the score home and listen to it, and I go, this is really nothing. It just really worked in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's other scores where I think it's brilliant, and I take it home, and I love listening to it, and then I think that's the ultimate. But, you know, some movies don't call for that kind of score.
Right.
And so, you know, it really matters that if it works in the film. I mean, that is absolutely number one priority. It's got to make the film a better experience for the audience in whatever direction that needs to be. If it also works when you take it away, that's an added bonus. That's like a big, you know, golden ticket cereal box.
And sometimes, because I'm a big collector of excuse me, CD soundtracks, and sometimes just the movie is such an overwhelming experience for me. Purchasing the score and listening to it, it's kind of evocative of the experience of watching that
mm-hmm.
film.
Very true.
I can't let you go without asking you about your work on The Lion King with Julie Taymor.
Yeah.
What was that experience like, and are you going to return to the stage anytime soon?
Well, you know, I wrote... When I did The Lion King originally, way back, you know, this was a situation where Hans again called me and said, would you produce the songs for the movie? It's called The King of the Jungle. And I'm kind of like, well, how much? And he said, I think it was $13,000. I'm like, I'm there. I'm there, man. Produce all the songs for the movie. No problem. I do it. So I got involved in that. And during that time, when I heard the songs, I thought they were really good. And I thought, they need a song for that one section where Simba looks in the reflecting pool and sees his own face. And Rafiki tells him that that's his father. And he says, no, that's just me. And she goes, no, that's your father. Hmm. And I thought that was so strong. So I wrote this song called He Lives in You. And I sort of had the idea. And I had the chorus. And I had the kind of idea in my back pocket. And eventually, when the movie came out and it sold $13 million, and I didn't really show the song to anybody because I was, you know, it wouldn't have been appropriate, but I eventually showed it to Disney came along and said, you guys want to make an album, songs, you know, inspired by one of those kind of albums.
Right.
Only we had really great, I think, really great African and wonderful additions to The Lion King songs that we had written through the experience, me and Lebo and Hans. So what was really cool is that Julie Taymor heard that CD. It's called Rhythm of the Pride Lands, and on that CD is pretty much the Lion King, the backdrop for the Lion King musical. When she heard that, she loved that way more than she liked the movie, and way more than she liked the soundtrack.
Mm.
And she said, "Get me the guy that did this. I want he lives in you. Who did that? Whoever did that, I want that guy to put the musical together with me." And so I got a phone call. And I went, and I didn't want to do The Lion King. In fact, I had just done Twister, and it was a huge movie, and I was, like, living large, and I was thinking, right, you know, I don't want to go do a remake of The Lion King now.
Right.
But I met with her, and she wanted Lebo involved, and he's the African singer that's involved in the movie. And when she said it was going to be the two of us putting it all together with her, I'm in.
Yeah, so, what a visionary talent Julie Taymor is.
Amazing.
Absolutely. She's doing Spider-Man on Broadway.
I know. You know, I just talked to her. We did an interview where we interviewed each other. It was really cool. And, you know, she's doing that with Bono and The Edge.
Oh,
wow.
They're writing the songs. And, you know, it will, believe me, because I know her, and it will change theater in a good way.
Oh, yeah.
It'll open up a lot of doors for people like me. Yes, I do want to do more theater. I really do. I was trying to get something going with Disney 7 years ago. I really think that people are hungry for theater where the soundtrack is a lot more current than what you get in musical theater.
Right.
If you know what I mean. I was pitching to them the idea of a Radiohead meets sort of Coldplay-esque type of score for a musical, rather than the sort of traditional thing. And
you sold me,
you know,
right there.
Well, you know what? I think they're very traditional company, so it really wasn't the right pitch to bring it to them. But that's who I know. I don't know anybody else really, you know, and in theater. And so I just pitched it to them. But then, wouldn't you know that, like, Spring Awakenings won all the Tonys, which is just really an alternative album.
Right. It is.
Yeah.
And it won everything because I think people are hungry because they're like, this is cool. It's like songs, and you know, I don't have to be embarrassed to have it in my car, you know. So,
so tell us what's next for you. What's coming up?
You know, I don't have anything next because I am in that mode where, you know, if you look at my track record, I bounce around a lot. I mean, you know, I was an action film guy and I was the action guy, and I kind of tried to get away from that and I tried to go a different direction. I'm really trying to do that right now. August Rush, I'm sort of waiting to see. You know, I want to see how people embrace it, because I mean, I know that people are embracing that movie on a certain level, a lot of people. It's not a blockbuster. It's not the movie of the year necessarily.
But it's magical.
It's yeah. very different. And I want to kind of let it resonate, and I want to see who surfaces out of that before I make a commitment, because otherwise, you know, otherwise I'm just on the next movie, and I've done that in the past, and I just want to wait. So that's kind of where I am.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You're attached as the composer to a movie called Meg.
Well, I'm also attached, you know, there's a movie called Stopping Power.
Right.
Those are both Jan's projects.
You would be a natural for Meg.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to do it.
From your love for Jaws, I think that would be the perfect vehicle for you.
Well, and we are planning to do that. It's just that it's not really necessarily, like, official. There isn't a green light, and there isn't a due date and all that kind of stuff, so... Yeah, there are things that are in my future that I'm doing, but I'm kind of, you know, immediately right now not sure exactly
right. What
the first thing will be.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you are a remarkable talent. We're crazy about you on the show. And
you're very kind.
August Rush is an amazing, amazing piece of work. And thank you so much for being with us. Come back and join us anytime you'd like.
I'd love it, guys. Thank you. It was really fun.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That is Mark Mancina. His new score is August Rush. Available in stores now, and of course it's in the theaters too.
Yes, it is.
Yes, great interview.
Very good interview, Jamie. You really, I have to say, and also because it's one of those rare instances where I was able to see the film and talk
yeah.
to him. He accomplished his goals, I mean, with that film from the first, like, 5 minutes.
It's certainly one of those films that lives or dies by its music, you know.
Oh, it owes a lot to its music.
Yeah,
He wasn't lying either about being the action guy for a while. I'm looking at his list. He's got, like, Speed, Twister, Con Air. Remember that awesome music in Con Air? Like,
I know.
The movie.
Yeah.
I'm not knocking the movie. I actually love the movie Con Air.
It's a good movie.
But it's undeniably a cheesy movie. It's intentionally cheesy.
Right.
And the soundtrack has got that, like, badass, like, squealing guitars and stuff in it.
That's a sure sign of how great he is, because all of those scores wind up in all the action movie trailers you see in the theaters now.
But you could do Shooter and August Rush the same year.
Yeah.
That's range and talent.
Yeah, it really is. Speaking of range and talent, I don't know that that's a smooth segue or not. There's a bunch of great films out now, or films that deserve discussion that we haven't really been able to touch upon yet. And I wanted to discuss them in this part of the show.
I'm all for it.
So what do we want to handle first? We've all three seen No Country for Old Men.
Well, maybe we should start with that.
Let's start with that. This is the new Coen Brothers film. Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, Tommy Lee Jones. How can I forget Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, how can you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great film, and I know anyone that's read any reviews, you're reading reviews that say best film of the year. For some reason, I don't think it's necessarily translated into box office this Thanksgiving weekend like we thought it would.
No, but it's in that sense, and I'll let you and Chris talk about it because I've run my mouth on them enough. I think, like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I think it will last a long time. It may not be in the top spot, but it's going to last throughout the holiday season.
Right.
Yeah, they're not really known for their box office power, typically.
Yeah, I mean, and even Fargo. I mean, Fargo, I don't know if it opened number one. I don't know.
It didn't open number one, but that and the one with Clooney, they did well, but not in, I guess, the terms of when we talk about number one or top box office, but they have an ability to stay around the multiplex for a couple months.
Right. Yeah, Oh Brother, you're right. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was like that, and that was largely thankful. I mean, don't get me wrong, the movie's brilliant, but it was largely thankful to the soundtrack, too. But
exactly.
I can see how this movie will be like that. People are going to be talking about it more and more. I'm already telling everyone I saw over the weekend, don't even bother going to see anything else. You need to go see No Country for Old Men.
That's the first thing that everyone should see.
So let's talk about why it's the best movie we've seen so far this year and what exactly we took from it. But Chris, if you want to start, I'd love to hear from you.
Well, what immediately jumped out at me, it's like I was telling you the other day, the Coen brothers had basically like a 20-year run, in my opinion, of just brilliant movies, from Blood Simple all the way up to The Man Who Wasn't There. I don't think that in that period they made a movie that I wouldn't give an A to. They're all A's.
That's a good point.
And they did kind of falter a little bit with Intolerable Cruelty and Lady Killers. They're just not, for anyone else, those would be decent little comedies. It would be, you know, oh, good for you. You made an interesting little comedy. But it's like the Coen brothers, like, it didn't make sense.
Especially the Lady Killers.
Yeah, because and you're updating something and really not bringing much to it, other than Tom Hanks' performance, I will say, I thought was really, really hilarious, and I thought they did good work together. But the movie itself, not so much.
Right.
This is like a complete return to form of them making like a movie that is truly exciting as you're watching it. Like, I mean, I don't know if I would say it's an edge-of-your-seat kind of thriller. It's not that kind of thriller. It's more of a psychological thriller.
Right.
It had me from the beginning to end. My girlfriend actually became ill from the violence in it, because it's so realistic, and it hits you so hard when it does hit you that it takes you a couple seconds to recover from it.
Yeah. And it doesn't... We talked about this the other day, Chris, that... It's one of those that visually it doesn't necessarily bear the stamp of the Coens as strongly as, you know, you're looking at Big Lebowski and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But it's just like Fargo, it's got that unmistakable Coen brothers sensibility to it. Just a little quirky, a little edgy, a little off-center somewhat.
Yeah.
You know, it's unmistakably the Coen brothers.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's just that Javier Bardem character is just a nightmare.
He's evil.
He is frightening. It has great, you know, Chris, you were talking yesterday about how it has great action sequences, you know, and it's cut. I think the editing is so incredible.
It's tight.
Because there's no real score. I mean, there's very little, if any, kind of music other than
I don't remember the music that well.
I think what I heard in an interview with them was they just were continually taking stuff out of the movie in the post-production process. They just really kind of whittled it down, boiled it down to this, like, it's an overused cliche, but a hard-boiled kind of movie, and that's how it ends up coming out. Even though it's so quiet, it feels like it's the loudest movie you've ever seen. Like, I mean,
yeah,
it's overloading your senses as you're watching it.
And so many movies that depend upon musical score to build up their tension,
right?
And that this one doesn't need it at all.
No.
Let's talk about the last part of the movie without giving anything away. I think it's safe to say that there's a slight shift in tone in the last, you know, 20...
Which part are you talking about? Tommy Lee Jones, or
I'm talking about the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Okay.
There's a slight switch in tone. It feels almost like, and this is what Chris and I were talking about, it feels almost like we've shown you all these ugly things for the past 2 hours. Now we're going to tell you what we feel about it in the last section of the movie. How did you feel about that ending, Jerry?
I can't get the ending out of my head. I really can't. I think Tommy Lee Jones, in the last three movies he's made, the one that he directed, The Three Burials,
yeah,
In the Valley of Elah, and this, they're kind of all, in one sense, the same character, but I can't get the last 5 minutes out of my head. There's something very beautiful to me about it.
Yeah.
Almost optimistic. And that's all I'm going to say about the ending, but I can't get his mood, his feeling, his mannerisms out of my head. They're just, for me, some of the best acting he's ever done, and I'm including the Executioner song when saying that.
I could not agree with you more. And you know, you're taken by Javier Bardem because
scared the hell out of me.
He's so great in the movie, and it's the most colorful kind of character. It's the villain, and that's who you're usually taken with when it's played well.
It's the centerpiece of the movie.
Excuse me.
But you leave thinking about nothing but Tommy Lee Jones. At least I felt that way.
No, you're right.
He is the haunted core of that movie. And you're right, the most amazing acting you're ever likely to see, especially in that last scene.
Yeah, I just can't get that out of my head.
Yeah, and it just takes on a kind of haunting quality,
mm-hmm.
and that's why the movie stays with you. And it doesn't feel forced or out of place, but it does play kind of like a commentary on what you've just seen.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah, and in that way it fits. You know, this movie might as well be called something like How the West Was Changed, because that's really what it's about. You know, about how there's no kind of code, there's no method to it anymore.
It's just changed. It's the
mass chaos.
It's like if some of Peckinpah's best films. It's like things have changed. The old gunslingers have outlived their usefulness almost.
Yeah.
Well, it's all straight from the book. They went with some really, really great source material this time. And
you couldn't ask for better source material.
That's the only Cormac McCarthy book that I've ever read completely, and it like really does follow the book. You know, I mean, we've all seen movie versions of books, and some are close, and some are, you know, really off. You know, there's Lawnmower Man's, and then there's Shawshank Redemption, and some of them are really good. But this
one... Where does Lawnmower Man rank?
You know what? I've always been crazy about the Lawnmower Man short story of Stephen
King.
That's
one of the most bizarre and absurd...
You know, it's
like,
a good short story, and it's
beautiful.
I like the movie.
It's got nothing to do with the movie.
I know, but I like the movie, though. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, you probably should have.
You should. I know I should have, but I mean, I don't mind it.
Yeah. Let's take Aaron's on the live. Let's take his call for like 2 or 3 minutes, and then I want to talk about a couple of these other movies. And Jerry, I know you have some definite thoughts about The Mist and Southland Tales, so let's try to get to that as well.
Okay. Yeah. Whatever.
Aaron, what you got to say to us?
I'm just calling in to defend the quote-unquote two lesser Coen Brothers films. I'm a big Coen Brothers fan, but I actually will come and defend, and not to be contrarian just for the sake of it, but I will defend Lady Killers and Intolerable Cruelty.
I'll defend the latter. I won't defend the first.
And the reason I'll defend Lady Killers Tom Hanks is great. Also, I think Irma P. Hall is terrific, and J.K. Simmons, and
Has Irma P. Hall really ever done anything other than that exact same performance in any movie she's been in the last 10 years, though? I mean, that's pretty much what she does now. You know, she comes on and she plays the
soulful
old lady with an
attitude
that slaps around the young guy.
I agree, Chris.
That's what she's known for, and that's what that's what you like her for. I mean,
but Tom Hanks is no Alec Guinness.
That is not what I like her for.
And I don't know why they would want to remake that of all movies.
Here's the difference. I don't hold the original Lady Killers on a pedestal.
I disagree with you. I think those films from that time, the Lady Killers, the Lavender Hill Mob, the Kind Hearts and Coronets, the Man in the White Suit. If I was Tom Hanks, who is obviously an excellent actor, I wouldn't want to touch any role that Alec Guinness was in. I don't care who you are. Those films have a special place.
Yeah.
And they are held to a high standard.
You don't want to see Tom Hanks play Obi-Wan Kenobi. Come on.
Yeah, well, in the prequel trilogy, I would have welcomed anything.
McGregor was a good Obi-Wan, but the thing but what the Coens do, especially just talking about Lady Killers on that film only, they take basically the story, but they've put it in the Southern Gothic, you know, kind of post leap of faith kind of gospel environment.
Right. I'll give you this, Aaron. If I had never seen the original, I would have said, hey, that's a pretty good movie. But because I am cursed, I guess, I have seen the original. It to me seems like a film stock is very expensive. It seemed like a waste to me.
Yeah.
I will fight for you on Intolerable Cruelty, though.
Yeah, Intolerable Cruelty. And I tell you, just to get one dig in before we get on Intolerable Cruelty, Lady Killers, Coen Brothers Lady Killers, not a waste of film stock. BAPS is. But that's another discussion.
I didn't know about, you know, I did not know BAPS had this, like, special place until 2 weeks ago. So, I mean,
The thing about the Lady Killers is it's not a bad movie, and it's the same with Intolerable Cruelty, but the problem I have with it in their career is that every movie they've done, they bring something really special to it. They bring something really special to a new genre or to a new kind of story. And I don't think that they brought anything to Lady Killers, especially because it was a remake. They didn't bring anything new to it.
They
didn't bring anything new to Intolerable Cruelty, which is basically romantic.
It's what you and I were talking about yesterday, Chris. We like the Coen Brothers movies because they feel alive.
Right.
Lady Killers does not. It just kind of unfolds before you, and you feel kind of apathetic about it. At least for the first hour of Intolerable Cruelty, I was laughing out loud. I thought there was a lot of inspired kind of...
I tell you why I think a lot of people were kind of weirdly apathetic to these last two Coen Brothers films as opposed to their others, because there are other films, and I say this as a Coen Brothers fan, so I'm not an anti-Coen Brothers person, but all of their films before these two mainstream studio-sanctioned films have that Coen Brothers quote-unquote quirk to them. Even their gangster film, which is what Miller's Crossing is, it's not a gangster film. It's a Coen Brothers take on a gangster film. Lebowski is a Coen Brothers take on a film noir, and so forth. But here they come up with these two films, and they are messing around in very tightly structured, studio-sanctioned formulas. You know, Lady Killers, kind of an old-style 50s comedy, but brought up to Southern Gothic, you know, comedy. And Intolerable Cruelty slaps, you know, 30s, screwball,
right.
But unlike Hudsucker, they're playing it straight, and that's what's interesting. And even when they play something straight, like Lady Killers or Intolerable Cruelty, they can't help but have their imprint somewhere in the corner, but it's such a tightly rigid structure that I think that, to me, is what's interesting, the Coen Brothers doing that.
Well, it's impossible for the Coen Brothers, who are great filmmakers, to make a film completely without merit.
Right.
But
right,
what we're saying is, in the overview of their entire career, these two films are obviously lesser.
That's where I get a little. That's the word I don't like. I don't consider them lesser films. I just consider them interesting tangents. The same way that Oh Brother is an interesting tangent. It's similar, I guess the way to compare this, and maybe my point would be a little better, is that right after Scorsese did Goodfellas, he does Cape Fear, and a lot of critics, and I love Cape Fear, but a lot of critics who liked Cape Fear thought that Scorsese was spinning his wheels to waste his time, quote-unquote, on what was basically a remake of a B-potboiler thriller.
Right.
But obviously we know what Scorsese did is he took a B-potboiler thriller and put his imprint on it without changing the structure of...
Well, you know, and that's one of the merits of Cape Fear. That's probably not
exactly
the main reason why I like Cape Fear. I like Goodfellas and Cape Fear equally because they're both equally emotionally involving, and Ladykillers is not.
But see, neither version of Ladykillers is that emotionally involving. I would even say the Alleghenies one is also kind of a stunt.
Yeah, I would too if I would have seen it. But
you haven't seen it?
All right, dude.
But you've seen Babs, haven't you?
Yes.
I work the craft services on Babs.
You oh, did? Wow. That with must have been a...
Did you work it with Busey?
Yeah. We were hanging out.
All right, man. Thanks for calling in. Giving us your take on the Coens there.
All right. Love you, Chris.
I love it how if something is... you can't just not like something. Sometimes, you know what? Sometimes, and I love the Coen brothers too, but sometimes good filmmakers make lesser movies.
Absolutely.
They're not interesting. That's exactly the problem with Ladykillers. It's not interesting. It's not involving.
No.
And likewise with the second half of Intolerable Cruelty. These are the lesser movies of the Coen brothers' career. It's unfortunate.
It sounds like almost the argument there was, and you know, he's very valid about a lot of things, so I'm not picking on Aaron, but I'm sure that the defenders of the Coen brothers, which we certainly are, but of these two movies in particular, would say, it almost sounds like the argument of, it's an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make a good film.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I want to say two things. I think the trailer for Intolerable Cruelty is excellent.
Look, I laugh out loud the first hour of Intolerable Cruelty.
Yeah, but I also want to say to Chris, thank you for the bringing up The Man Who Wasn't There, because a lot of people don't give that film enough credit for what it is.
Yeah.
No, the movie's brilliant, and it gets better every time. And actually, it's one of their most unique films in that it doesn't, you know, obviously, I was saying to Jamie the other day that they kind of have two feels that their movies often have. They're either like the quirky screwball kind of thing, or they're that dark, brooding sort of noir film.
Yeah,
and that one I think really is the best example of how they can take a very, you know, there's no violence in the movie, not only one scene of violence really, unlike Fargo or Big Lebowski, Blood Simple, No Country for Old Men. It's a very quiet, very reserved kind of movie. It's a lot about manners and things like that.
Right,
and it's really striking how much you're into this character and how much you feel for this character by the end of the movie.
And it could be on the outside, it could be said of that movie, an experiment, you know.
But it's an experiment that's very interesting.
But it involves you. It really does. And especially, and I don't know how they do it, especially with a lead character that couldn't be less emotionally.
I hope they'll work together again, though.
Oh, yeah.
I really hope they'll come together and work again.
I would love to see behind... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sort of saying I think it's his best performance. Outside of Sling Blade, obviously, which again is like one of those Javier Bardem, it's like one of those Antoine Chigurh parts. It's very showy. It's the centerpiece of the movie. It's hard to compare the two performances, but it really shows his range.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to go and do something like Ed Crane.
I would love to see some behind-the-scenes footage of them shooting Billy Bob Thornton in a take and him doing absolutely nothing and them saying, "You're giving us too much. Tone it back."
They say that on the DVD of the movie. It's very interesting. They're like, "Oh, well, we wrote this part, and I don't want to say that Billy Bob Thornton brought it to life, because I don't think that would be appropriate." But,
Now, Jerry, you saw The Mist.
I saw The Mist, and, you know, as I talk about this, the movie did not perform very well over the weekend. I can understand why to an extent, but I had to take a long walk after watching this movie.
Okay.
It's a disturbingly brilliant film from Frank Darabont, and after watching The Mist, he should be the only person allowed to make any more adaptations of Stephen King's work.
Yeah.
He is the only person right now who gets King and can bring it to life. This film is a great horror movie in the tradition of the great monster movies of the 50s. This film will bring back especially the tone of the great sci-fi and anthology series like The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits.
Yeah, but none of the kind of cheese factor.
I don't think there's any cheese. And
this is a down and dirty horror movie, isn't it?
It's a very down and dirty horror movie, but and I'm going to be crucified for saying this. It's also maybe for all the things that we talk about message movies and political movies.
Yeah.
I think Frank gets it right in this film.
Mm-hmm.
More so than anyone else in the last 5 or 10 years. This film is very frightening in a sense, not so much of what's outside the supermarket,
yeah,
it's what's inside the supermarket.
What the fear and paranoia creates in
the paranoia, the fear.
Right.
And that's very frightening. We talked in our May show about 28 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the points I brought up was in the terms of that movie, how quickly when a person's infected, they become a zombie within seconds. Really, it doesn't even take minutes. It's very rapid. And here, when the laws and civility are thrown out the window, and we go back to our primal instincts, it's very frightening and very unnerving. I will also add that Mr. Darabont is one of the few filmmakers to make, in certain instances in the film, a commentary on class in America. And I just say, and all I have to say is, go see the film. It's worth your time. The ending is different from the book that I have not, unfortunately, read the novella that this is based on, and I feel very horrible about that now after seeing the film. But this film is worth anyone's time.
Yeah, but the way you're describing it, I mean, let's make sure it's known. These are themes that are just thinly underlying. It's an entertaining ride of
horror. Oh, it's an entertaining.
Primary thing isn't to hit you over the head with a message.
Nothing. No, there's no. No, it doesn't do anything like that.
Yeah.
But it's there. It's there. If
right.
You dig just even a little bit. It's not. It's not subtle. And not too subtle. It is a little subtle, but it's. I did not expect this, and I should have, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I knew I was very curious about there were a lot of good reviews written in the press and online about this, and I just feel really horrible that I never read Skeleton Crew and its novellas, because obviously I was not aware of that, how important this story was to a lot of people growing up.
Mm.
And I think, like I said, I think Frank should always direct Stephen King's work.
Interesting how he can direct the monster movie Stephen King, and the heartwarming human drama.
It's amazing.
He's cornered both markets there.
Yes.
Yeah. Now let's see what happens with The Dark Tower, if anything comes of that series.
Do you think? Let me ask you that, and I'm going through that over the years. I'm halfway through that. Do you think that should be filmed?
I think it might. I think HBO needs to look at it personally.
I think as an episodic series on HBO, it could work. As a motion picture, I don't think so.
Yeah. I think episodic HBO. Krista, what kind of have you read Stephen King's The Mist? Or?
No, I've never read The Mist. I've read a lot of Stephen King, you know, a lot of the books and a lot of the short stories, but I've not read that one. No.
Yeah, but Darabont seems to understand. I mean, part of it is just that he's a dynamite storyteller. But he seems to understand and connect to Stephen King, I think because he doesn't denigrate it. I mean, he doesn't look down upon it.
Well, no, he's a writer himself, first and foremost, you know,
yeah,
before,
that's right.
Before anything. And he's a great writer. And he's also, if you see him in interviews, very smart guy, very intelligent, not only about storytelling, but about movies. And
yes, he is.
He Stephen King loves his movies. You know, he's the first to come out and say that he thinks Darabont does a great job with his work. And Darabont, you know, it's just one of those great collaborations, Scorsese and Schrader. Like, they just
mm-hmm.
have kind of this, like, artistic love affair going
That's
on.
That's a good analogy.
That's absolutely
For some
right.
reason, it works very, very well.
And if I could just add one more thing to the people. And this is at its heart a monster movie, and he does pay loving homage to the movies of the 50s, like Them, The Praying Mantis, the Beginning of the End. That's all there. And it's just, it's not, like as you say, it's not insulting. It doesn't condescend. It's very respectful of the source material.
Yeah, but you can tell, like, some of these lesser Stephen King films, lesser films based on Stephen King films,
right?
That they might just look down on pop culture, you know?
Right, absolutely.
It's just a little thriller thing, a horror movie thing. Frank Darabont doesn't have that. I mean, he has a real, like Chris said, a real respect for the art of story, and Stephen King's a master at it. That's
he is a master.
As long as he has.
What worries me, and I think I said this to you on Wednesday night, Jamie, what was wrong with his script for Indiana Jones 4?
Yeah.
I really am nervous now about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, who knows if there was anything wrong with it, actually. You're dealing with, imagine trying to write something that will please Harrison Ford, Spielberg, and then worst of all, Lucas, too.
I know, there's no Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah,
yeah,
you got to write something to please all three of those guys. One of them is notoriously controlling with his work, and
too
the other
controlling.
Another of which is just a master of storytelling in his own right. And,
right.
I would argue that Harrison Ford's a better storyteller or a better judge of dialogue, of script, of story construction than George Lucas.
You hear no argument from a lifelong Star Wars fan. You're absolutely right.
But, yeah, I guarantee you that a lot of Darabont's script is going to show up on the screen.
I hope you're right.
And I think he's very sour about it. Yeah. Understandably so. Well, it was a big assignment. He said he's done being a writer for hire now, no matter what.
Yeah, well, good for him. Because,
good for him. He proved himself on this without a doubt.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just saying I hope he makes more movies because he's one of those guys that in 13 years now. He's only made 4 movies, so.
Yeah.
I hope he makes more.
Absolutely.
Whether they're Stephen King or not, I don't think that The Majestic was a great movie. It wasn't as bad as everyone said. No, it wasn't as bad as everyone says, but I don't think that people need to peg him as only needing to make Stephen King movies from now on.
Right.
I know that's not what you're saying, Jerry. You're just saying Stephen King movies should only be made by Frank Darabont.
No.
I'm not against that either. I just think that he's talented enough. He can branch out.
I think he could come up with his own, without a doubt.
Chris, what did you think of Donnie Darko?
I enjoyed Donnie Darko very much. I thought that it was a really fun, original kind of movie with a lot of problems with the script, I thought. I didn't think that the script was the strongest in the world. I mean, it's basically one of those scripts that plays with the time sequence. So
right, the time travel.
All those kind of scripts, if you put them in a linear order, you sort of notice that the script really isn't that strong to begin with. The storytelling device adds more to it. But ultimately, I think it's a good movie, and I've watched it a couple times and enjoyed it every time.
Richard Kelly's new movie just got released, Limited, Southland Tales.
And it came and went.
Yeah, anyone that knows anything about this movie probably first heard buzz about it at Cannes Film Festival this year, where it was met with an ocean of boos. And apparently, not booze liquor, but the booze is in.
That's being kind, Jamie.
Possibly booze liquor. And so some rejiggering kind of went on with the film, and it's finally came out and went, as Jerry said. But Jerry, you got a chance to get a look
at it. I made the special trip to go downtown to see this film, and I need to add to what Chris was saying about Donnie Darko. I didn't see it until it came out on DVD because it was a casualty of September 11th. It came and went very quickly in its limited release. I think less than a week, Donnie Darko played in our neck of the woods.
Right.
And I watched it twice in one night. I finished watching it and I was like, wow, what did I just watch? And I watched it again. And like a lot of people, I really enjoyed the film. I know it's considered pretentious, and we had a guest over for Thanksgiving who thought it was pretentious, but I really enjoyed the movie. Southland Tales is a mess. It's been now, since last Friday, it's been well over a week since I've seen it. I would originally give Southland Tales a 7 out of 10. I think I may give it an 8 out of 10 now.
Yeah.
I think there are some issues, if you read what I wrote for Geeks of Doom, there are some things I would have just cut out of the film. But I think where his heart, when he sticks to Los Angeles, he always envisioned Southland Tales not so much as this futuristic movie, but as a sort of commentary on, a satire on Hollywood, and especially of life in Los Angeles.
Right.
He gets that right. I actually think that part of the film is brilliant. I think there's some other parts of the film that are a mess, but I can't come out against a film where someone has so much ambition, and yes, it's reckless ambition, and we're not... Someone made the comparison to Heaven's Gate, and that film has aged actually better than anyone would have thought. You know, people actually regard that film as a good film now.
Right.
And it's not like Richard Kelly, like Michael Cimino, charged the studio to use his land for the film and made a killing. There was no land to charge here, and it didn't bankrupt the studio working on it. But
Heaven's Gate's kind of an excessive, his own eccentricity.
That speaks to Kelly's, too.
Well, I see Kelly as more like free form, and ambition is excess as in he lets his mind, he doesn't constrict where his mind goes.
Right.
It's kind of, and I admire movies like that, and they rarely work 100%.
No, this one doesn't work.
This is why I like Wild at Heart, because it's filled with ideas, and there's no way it can be like one 100% cohesive piece of work.
That's right.
It doesn't exist in that realm.
No, it doesn't.
You can't expect it.
And that's a good analogy, Jamie. Wild at Heart's a very good analogy for this film. I think this film, over the years, with DVD releases, will have a cult following. I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah.
I like the film. I'm not going to jump on the bandwagon and crucify it. It's just too ambitious. But I will say this, and we were talking about Mr. Lucas earlier. There does need to be, there should have been someone on the set to say, you might not want to do this. You might want to cut this down.
Yeah.
I think that would have been let's
remember. I mean, we have talented people working in films. We have great artists. Artists don't necessarily hit the mark 100% of the time.
No, they don't.
The true sign of an artist is when their ambition exceeds their grasp.
That's right.
But they keep reaching for it.
Yeah,
that should be applauded.
And I have to say this about Southland Tales, and this would be the best endorsement I could ever give any film. It's the film I've always wanted to make.
Yeah.
And that's an...
Well, we're all rising up to see it now.
it's the film I've always... Even with the bad press, I can't get over how much he pays homage to Kiss Me Deadly and Repo Man and all these other films. But his ambition is so seductive.
Yeah. Chris, are you about to say something?
Well, I was just going to kind of add to what you were saying about how artists don't hit the mark 100% of the time. That's very true. And also, let's not forget that Richard Kelly is a very young guy.
Yeah.
Young artists in particular, sometimes, you know, it's not unusual for a really talented guy to come out with his second movie and be so ambitious and really kind of overshoot and people don't sort of get it. Sometimes it just takes young artists a while to sort of feel out their limitations.
And if you're
going to
fail, you need to do it.
He's going to fail. He did it quite, and I don't even think he failed, because I wanted to love this film. I do love this film. And these are, God, I wish he would have come on the show.
I know, we tried to get him.
I have to say this. He wants, the next film is The Box, which is based on a Richard Matheson story.
Right.
And he has said, you know, in interviews, I think, this is to prove that I can make a studio movie that can fill seats. And I hope it does, because I want more films like Southland Tales. I want more of this guy's imagination.
Doesn't that kind of feel like he's saying, this proves that I can be a sellout just like everyone else?
That's a good, I mean, I didn't think of it like that, but you're right.
That's a little depressing.
It's a little depressing, but I understand, because they want to like say, hey, I wonder if that was made to... He made Donnie Darko, he wrote the script that Domino's based on. I knew as soon as I said that one of you guys was going to do that.
Once again, though,
I didn't know it would be you, though.
You can't ever judge, and it sounds like a funny statement, but you can't judge a script by the movie that comes out. You can't do that.
Right. I understand. But
I haven't read it myself. I'm just judging the movie. Yeah, no, I agree. The movie was a mess. But
it's a two-disc
special. Don't you think it was Tony Scott trying to recapture the last 10 minutes of True Romance for a two-hour film?
Yeah, it definitely felt like
it's a two-disc special edition DVD for $3 at Walmart.
Will you buy it for me? I'll pay you back the postage.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But look at all the talent that already, from the very beginning, all the talent that was attracted to Donnie Darko, all the talent that was attracted to Southland Tales. And even the box, look at the kind of talent that that's getting. It's got, Cameron Diaz and James Marsden.
Right, that's right, Chris.
And who else? I think Franklin Jella, is that right? That was.
I'm not positive. Another
good actor, older guy like that.
You're right, Franklin Jella.
Yeah. Yeah, and these are talented people. They're not stupid. They recognize that, who cares? This guy made a sophomore movie that was not so great. He's clearly talented.
But don't you think... in years to come, and this is my argument, I think Southland Tales will be regarded like, you know, in like 5-10 years, you know, hey, this film was trying to do something.
Yeah.
Hey, who's to say? I haven't seen the movie, but, you know, weirder movies have caught on, you know, a couple years after it happens.
Right, exactly. Like Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I just pulled a movie out of my ass. Sorry. Last thing I want to talk about a little bit for a very short time is American Gangster.
Okay, cool.
Chance to see that this weekend. And Jerry, you'd given your critique on that a couple of weeks ago, so I wanted to.
No, please. I want to hear what you have to say.
Give my follow up. It's fine. You know, all the criticisms I've heard about it is that it's just not quite. It should feel like it's a lot greater than it is. And. It should. Part of it is like we've been through this territory before. But the best part of the movie to me was the Russell Crowe character. The Denzel Washington character, I didn't like the way it was played or written or both.
What was it that you didn't like, though, about
his
character?
It was the moral kind of sketchiness. And not so much as I didn't know how he felt about what he was doing. I didn't know how he felt about killing that man,
right,
killing those people, or destroying Harlem.
And he does do that. I mean,
he absolutely does that. And then it shows him handing out turkeys to needy families, and he's, you know, he's the guy that everybody looks up to in the neighborhood, but he's destroying Harlem. I didn't see any colors to this character, and I think that Denzel Washington might have been the wrong person to play it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because he's not. I don't know that he's good at ambiguity. I think it was pretty damn clear cut that he was just a corrupt cop in Training Day. That was his character. That was his drive. That was his through line. He played it. He had fun with it. I mean,
he had
reveled in it. This is a lot. I don't know that Denzel necessarily knows what he's doing all the way through his character arc, and I think it's somewhat disgraceful the way this character is portrayed.
You're not the first person to say this.
And it's disgraceful that, you know, the real-life guys on talk shows now sit next to Denzel Washington, and no matter how the events turned out, which that's portrayed in the movie, and it's, you know, it's real life, you can look it up, but he's responsible for thousands, possibly, deaths. And it just feels a little icky. And there's a closing montage of the two lead actors kind of laughing together and stuff after all.
You felt that was in bad taste.
I thought it was in bad taste, yeah.
Okay, this is an important thing to bring up because it is something that I think David Denby in The New Yorker brought this up too. I mean, one of the big stories I think a week before the movie came out was that they bought him a house on Frank Lucas or something, or they had helped him buy a house.
Yeah,
it's
not that it glorifies violence or drug use. I think the great, certainly not drug use, because I think the great scene in it is the Thanksgiving table, and he's having Thanksgiving with his family, and interspersed with that are cuts of, you know, Harlem dying around,
right? No,
overdoses. It's just that it doesn't feel one way or another about it, about the violence and about what he did. You know, the devastation he caused.
No, he does cause a lot of devastation, and
there's something about the emotional involvement that we were talking about too. Ridley Scott movies
are awesome spectacles. I mean, they're just atmospheric. They're like oil paintings. You feel like you can touch them and swoosh through
the
colors.
Well, I think they're better than oil paintings.
Well, yeah, but I'm thinking of that artist mentality.
Right.
They're
technical wonders.
They're technical wonders, but you don't think there's any, like, emotion.
Yeah, they're almost like museum pieces.
Right.
And like museum pieces, they're just looked at, but not really let in. I mean,
I could see
he makes the kind of movies that Stanley Kubrick would make if Stanley Kubrick just let in a little bit of emotion. You know, Ridley Scott's on that other side. Like, he makes very cold movies with just a little bit of emotion. Stanley Kubrick's movies have none. You know?
Some Ridley Scott movies, I would 1492, I would definitely grant you that. Just because my friend went to the bathroom for an hour and came back and asked, did I miss anything? I said, no, nothing's happened. But... I'm serious. That happened. I wish I had video footage of that. But G.I. Jane. But there are other films. I do think the first three films, especially The Duelist, Alien, and The Blade Runner, I disagree with that assessment, but that's just me.
I kind of disagree about it with Alien. Yeah. I don't with Blade Runner, and I don't mind it with Blade Runner, because you and I were talking about this before the show.
Right.
You think about the difference between a human being and a replicant. Then you think about the difference between an emotionally involving movie and a replicant movie that's trying to replicate that kind of sensation.
You don't think
Blade Runner
is emotional? I'm also looking at this from a sixth grader's perspective, though, Blade Runner, so you'll forgive me. No, I am, because that's when I saw, you know, the opening night, and it was a very, you know, it's a very involving film for me at that time. It still is, but...
Right. Oh, it's awesome. I mean, it's awe-inspiring. But it just kind of, that's how it feels to me. And it feels consistent with the theme, I mean, the way I just described it.
Well, I think it's also consistent. Actually, we go on this some with the newer cuts of the film that he is a replicant, it turns out. So the argument is in your favor, actually.
Right.
But I guess I feel that differently about some of the films. Some of the films I'll give you... I think it just depends your mood, but I understand the point you're making. It's a valid point, but I think for American Gangster, I think is one of his more accomplished films of the millennium.
This is
me. I mean,
it's ambitious. And
it's very ambitious. Let me ask you this, though.
It has all the motions right. It's just slightly out of tune with the music. I mean, there's something missing.
I can definitely see where someone would make that point. Kent, let me ask you this. What do you think of the film in comparison with, not the original Scarface, but the De Palma remake? What are your feelings?
Scarface is far better.
You think so? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Mostly,
but I think it's obvious that that's the kind of reaction they're trying to get with this movie. And I haven't even seen it, but just from the marketing blitz that they've done with this movie, it's very clear that they're trying
to go after that crowd.
They're trying to get that crowd, and I think that kind of explains the way they sort of walk that line you guys are talking about in between, you know, moral ambiguity, and I think that's why. I think they kind of want it to be a little bit nasty.
They do.
They want people to react to that nastiness a little bit.
And I don't think Denzel's sold on it. What Scarface doesn't have is the Russell Crowe subplot, and that's important. But what Scarface does have is a clear-cut character. You never question his motivations. He is a machine of ambition. And
he's hard as nails.
And ruthlessness.
Oh, his ruthlessness is undeniable.
That informs everything he does. There's no ambiguity with Tony Montana. He is a walking id, you know? He is,
good.
And like Pacino loved him, he is a two-dimensional character.
All right, quick question, though. Frank Lucas and Antoine Chigurh from No Country for Old Men are out to kill each other. Who wins?
Antoine Chigurh.
Oh, absolutely.
And I wish, though, and can I add this, though? I wish that Javier Bardem would have killed a lot of the characters in The Love of Time of Cholera, too.
What a terrible title for a movie. I don't care if the book has the same title. That's not going to bring them out in droves. Hey, let's celebrate Thanksgiving. Let's go see Love in the Time of Cholera.
Well, it's better than Cholera in the Time of Love.
The movie might as well be called Shoot Yourself in the Mouth. You know? Which I saw a movie like that. It was an adult film, though. But all right. So
So any last words, guys?
Looking forward to There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, I think that's, and I have to say, Chris is absolutely right. I think this is the film that, this could be the big one.
Yeah.
And if that's, if it's not, then it belongs in No Country for Old Men. But I think that, this movie, just if anyone's seen the trailer, Daniel Day-Lewis is like channeling like John Huston in this
mm-hmm.
ungodly way.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
But having not seen it, all I can say is that in a year that's been pretty lackluster as far as really good adult movies, I'm talking Oscar-worthy movies, No Country for Old Men is the best movie of the year. It's the most original. It's the most
mm-hmm.
exciting. It's got the best performances. It's the movie to see. Nobody is has made a movie like this year.
Yeah, and it's
the
movie
film to beat right now.
It's a film I think that all three of us can agree on. You walk out and you can say, that's a masterpiece.
Right, and you want to talk about it. You want
yeah.
to talk about it immediately. You want to find someone else that's seen it so that you can talk about it with them.
Absolutely.
It's just, it's got ideas. It's got images. It's got it all. It's a really, it's clearly the best movie of the year so far.
I agree.
I think all three of us are in agreement on that.
Thank God.
We will be handicapping. Isn't that something? There's you know, when we're all three in agreement, there's no need for this.
No need for us to get into a fist fight.
A little late with the sound effect there. But we'll be handicapping the Oscar race, you know, as the weeks go by. And it's going to be an interesting race just because there's so little to choose from.
Oh, it should make it exciting. It should have all those movies that we want to see in there. No Country for Old Men, Zodiac, you know.
Zodiac. I don't, do you think, let me ask you this before we go. Do you think Zodiac could pull like the Silence of the Lambs and the Academy will remember that far back?
I don't think it's going to take a lot of awards, but I do think that they're going to have to call back on movies like that earlier in the year because there's just not that much out.
You know what we talked about earlier, and I know we talked about there's an excessive Academy nominations, but would you think for that film, would you say that film deserves like a special ensemble cast award?
You know, at another award show, yes, it's not going to happen at the Oscars. They're
no,
not
but
do that.
I would. The three leads in that film are incredible.
No, they're great, and it's going to be difficult to try and pull one of those guys for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, I think you'll see him nominated for SAG Ensemble.
Right.
Yeah.
If you do see an acting nomination for that movie, I'm going to go on record, it's going to be Downey is going
to
get it.
Oh, absolutely.
Supporting. I do think that's going to happen. Unfortunately, I think he's going to lose to Javier Bardem. I'm going on record with that. Right.
Okay, I'm for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, Wednesday night, Blog Talk Radio CEO Alan Levy. And we will see you Wednesday night.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
All right. See you later.